comes. So one, two, three.
Tobin.
Kathy.
We are still in the closet.
Yes. More specifically, we're still in my closet recording together in Los Angeles.
Yeah. A week has definitely passed. But we are here in your nice, cozy closet in Los Angeles where I like to visit you. Mm-hmm. And I am jealous every time I come.
You know, you like New York okay, don't you?
I like it okay.
It's going to be your first winter there. How are you feeling about that?
It's going to be magical with, you know, snow and ice and coats.
Wow, the sincerity. The sincerity dripping in your voice.
It's gonna be great.
Anyway, mm-hmm. We're back here with another little gift for you Nancy listeners, and this one is a doozy.
And what does this gift look like this time?
If I were to describe this gift, I would say it's a giant box wrapped in our dreams.
What does our dream look like?
Glitter and stardust.
Okay, sure. But I think more importantly, when you open this box, mm-hmm. inside you find a star. Someone who has appeared in Jurassic Park. Someone who was in Law and Order SVU.
Oh my God.
Someone who is in the upcoming Comedy Central show called Awkwafina is Nora from Queens.
Our guest today is Mother Fudging B.D. Wong. We got the chance to interview BD live on stage at Asia Society in New York, and there was so much to talk about. He's had such an amazing career.
Yeah, like when he won the Tony in 1988 for his role in the Broadway play M. Butterfly.
Now, I believe that you would consider this girl to be a deranged idiot, correct? Oh, but because it's an Oriental who kills herself for a Westerner, you find it beautiful.
He starred as a Chinese opera star who disguises himself in drag to hide his true identity as a spy for the Chinese government.
And we also can't forget, he was in Margaret Cho's groundbreaking sitcom, All-American Girl.
And this is my mute sister, Margaret.
Bonjour, Tammy.
She's a French mute. Well, we're off.
It was the first primetime sitcom to feature an all-Asian American cast. BD played Margaret's older brother on the show.
So, long story short, we had a lot we were curious about when we talked with BD about his career.
Which is why we wanted to start all the way back at the beginning by talking about his childhood growing up in San Francisco.
We want to start by going back to the beginning.
Oh, God. Okay.
We all have in common that we are California Asians.
Oh, yeah.
You grew up in San Francisco.
I grew up in San Francisco, yeah.
Growing up, did you feel connected and part of an Asian community?
I did. In some ways, I was kind of forced to by my parents because we moved out to the Sunset District, which is kind of, at the time, it was not Asian at all. Like, we were among the first families to move out there. And it removed us from a proximity to Chinatown that was, I could feel, when I look back on it too, I could feel that my parents were very, very torn about this. They were kids that grew up in Chinatown, San Francisco. They were born and raised in San Francisco. They spoke Chinese. They were more attached to the root culture than my brothers and I ended up being. And so it was a big step for them to move out to the avenues. And I could feel them struggling with it. Immediately, the first thing that happened was when my younger brother and I did not have to go to Chinese school, which we were thrilled about.
Oh, my God, I'm so jealous.
We were off the hook, actually. And then, so as a way of kind of making up for that, my parents sent us to the YMCA in Chinatown every week for a good part of our childhood and early teen years to be a part of a boys' youth group, which was super kind of very geared towards teaching young Chinese-American boys about being Chinese, you know, just kind of being in Chinatown and all of that stuff, but was also kind of like the non-gayest thing ever. Right? So it was very sports-driven. I was super not into that part of it. I didn't respond to any of the activities that ever were brought up.
What were you guys doing?
Playing sports, playing basketball, or I actually was into some of the things like community service and going to hospitals and stuff like that. Other stuff that the other boys didn't like at all. As far as being in San Francisco, I grew up in the 70s. It was like kind of a gay fantasy world in some ways for a kid who was like an adolescent kid in San Francisco when people were exploring all these things, and you could have interaction with gay people who were actually kind of out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that formed my understanding of the power of being out and the importance of it, and yet the fear of it, mm-hmm. all intertwined, completely intertwined.
And how did you find your way to acting and then eventually becoming an actor?
Yes, this is good. I was a young violin playing kid, and I was allowed by my parents to play the violin. Of all the things that I chose to do that was not like academic and the one performance-related thing that they were kind of into, whether it's a stereotypical reason or not, they were okay with me playing the violin. And I played the violin for many years from like fourth grade to 10th grade. And I had private lessons. I took it very seriously. I was apparently really good at it. You know, I was, and it was in 10th grade that a teacher came into my class, like a math class or something, and said, "We're recruiting kids to play for the school play, the school musical. We're putting together an orchestra for the school musical." Mm-hmm. And I turned to my friend Sherry Samuel, who was a little bit of an actress, and I said, "That's what I'm going to do. I want to play for the school musical. That sounds like fun." And she says, "Oh no." The action is not in the orchestra pit. The action is on the stage. Mm. And I said, I was kind of secretly hoping someone would make me go to the tryout instead. And she was going to the tryout. She dragged me there. And it began this relationship with my drama teacher, which opened the doors for me completely. She really saw something in me. She begged me and implored me and demanded that I not squander the potential of my gifts. And she played a big role in this kind of grand negotiation with my parents about my future, about what I would choose to do, even extracurricularly, and then later on, going into the professional world. Mm. And that was crucial for me. I had a lot of moxie, but I had a lot of trepidation about kind of whether being an actor was even viable for lots of reasons that we all know. And I wasn't sure about it. And she made me consider it. And she made my parents consider it. And my parents then considered it, really. They came around. My older brother, who is 9 years older than me, became a doctor. And that was kind of like a mixed blessing for me. He was a straight-A student who created a lot of pressure for me because he was the Marsha Brady of the family. And yet, at the same time, he became a doctor, and they ticked that box off.
And you were good.
And then I was off the hook, kind of. And I think, I mean, I you have to ask my mom, who will probably have a hilarious recounting of this. But what her perception of this was. But they came around is how I recall.
Wow. Yeah.
And I realized this. This is, you know, part of our kind of juju together, our interaction, and even intergenerationally, that this is a thing. I go to colleges and universities, and the biggest question is, I'm Asian American, I'm studying this, I don't want to study this, I want to do that, what do I do? Mm. And I'm put in a position where I have to kind of say, I want you to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
But your parents paid for you to come here. And the university paid for me to come and speak to you. So,
part of the education.
But I do encourage them to follow their bliss, of course. I mean, I'm the example for them in some ways of how that can be all right.
Yeah. Well, so you had this, arguably your big break, or one of many breaks, is your Tony-winning role in M. Butterfly, which was incredible. Yeah, go ahead.
You weren't even born.
The YouTube clips. The YouTube clips are amazing. But we wanted to ask, though, that, you know, there's so many themes in that play around gender and sexuality.
Yeah.
What did it change for you in your understanding of gender and sexuality?
If it didn't change anything in the moment when it was happening, it certainly activated things. And in some ways, it created tension in myself that I needed to kind of have happen. Because of all of the stuff about watching television and being very desperate and kind of not sure about becoming an actor, I had really weird Asian self-esteem. I didn't want to be Asian. I didn't want to be Asian, and I didn't want to be gay. And those two things actually were kind of intertwined. I now this is kind of the theme of my college speech, is that I feel a real parallel between being an ethnic minority and being a gay person because of the way the negotiations that I had to do in my mind to get over both of those things. Neither of those things I wanted to be. And I think the reason why I didn't want to be those things is because I wanted to be an actor, and because being an actor meant those things were not, they didn't go together. And when I was a kid watching television, I thought, well, if you want to be an actor, that's the actor I want to be. Matthew Broderick is who I wanted to be. And I would have had an operation to turn me into Matthew Broderick in a heartbeat. If there was GoFundMe at the time, I would have GoFundMed me a Matthew Broderick nose, and I would have been really happy doing that. But the feelings were that when I went into M. Butterfly, I was very cynical and very kind of really not in a great place about it. And M. Butterfly kind of overnight. Well, first of all, at the time when I was debating flying myself to New York to audition for the play, I finally read this play, and it was the first play I'd ever read that had an Asian guy's, an Asian person's, Asian writer's name on the front of the cover. And I had been struggling over the years to understand what my place was, what my voice would be, what I could, you know, the technique that I was learning from my acting teacher was this philosophy of being a messenger. And I thought, well, that's great. I'll be a messenger. But what does that really mean? I wasn't 100% sure. And kind of magically, I read this play. And the play had in it all of these things that I felt about being an Asian man in the media, about how we're treated that way and what the things that we do in order to compensate for that and the trickery of racism and all of that stuff. And I entered into this play that luckily became a big success. And it changed my self-esteem about being Asian because we were treated very well. It was a huge success. We, you know, were given prizes and stuff like that. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm super Asian now. Like, I became uber-like Asian. And I was thrilled about this. It was really great. And if you know, the play is about the 20-year relationship between a French diplomat and a Chinese actress who turns out to be a man. And the kind of world falling apart of this French diplomat when he realized that his paramour is not the ultimate Chinese stereotypical flower that he thought she was. And the irony was that I was, you know, making speeches about Uber Asian, and I couldn't go to the gay place. I was in a play with this other actor, and we were ostensibly in a kind of same-sex relationship, actually, technically. I would steer all conversations away with it, and it took me a long time to kind of figure it out. It wasn't until the birth of my son and the subsequent book that got published about him that I got on board with being gay and came out, like actually came out for real, beyond my own personal life.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, you've also talked about growing up and watching TV and film and only seeing white faces, basically.
Yes, right. I have to say, and I really don't want to toot my own horn, or like, this is not a self-congratulatory thing, but I became so desperate about it. And I remember I moved to L.A. I was living there, and I finally met for the first time. After moving to, I first came to New York from San Francisco in let's not say what year. And then I spent a few years here. And then by circumstances, I ended up in L.A. And it was the first time when I was in L.A. that I met a community of Asian American actors. And I met a community. There was a very well-established Asian American theater there that's still there. And I met these people, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this is what it means to be an Asian actor. There's a thing. It's called an Asian actor, and that's what it looks like, and that's what it is, and that's how it interacts with other members of its own species in its natural habitat. And I thought, oh, I see what this is. But I realized, I remember I went to an event kind of an advocacy event, an awards. It was at the time when they would give awards to producers for hiring Asians for various things, you know, kind of a media awards kind of thing. And I was standing in the back. I was volunteering. I was new in town, and I was, like, kind of volunteering there. And I remember thinking, oh, I see. This is what it is. If you want that career, you want that success, you have to commit to being an agent in some kind of change of it. It's not working. The system's broken. It didn't work for you as a consumer when you watch TV as a young kid. And so if that's, you do the math. It's not going to change unless somebody, like, kind of bangs the door down. And so I didn't know what that meant at all. I just knew that it meant I couldn't be passive about it. Like I tried to begin to adopt at a very young age a way of discussing it, even in the way that we're discussing it now, that a lot of people of my generation were doing at the time and continue to still do. And that's also a byproduct of this desperation, right? It's like there are times when you go, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to be so good at talking about this? Or why can't I just act, really, is what you want to do. But by the same token, it's extremely good for you. It feels good. It feels like, I feel like this is part of who I am now. And I don't mind it at all. I think it's kind of great. I like it. I'm like that I've been forced to become this person.
More with BD after the break.
We're back.
Let's jump right back into our conversation with motherfudging BD Wong.
You have this thing about your career. You're in a lot of things that were firsts, right? Or like forefront kind of things. So like All American Girl you were part of.
Right, yeah.
Which was the Margaret Cho, all Asian cast TV show.
Yeah.
And also this moment you had in M Butterfly. And you've talked before about the pressure of like, this thing cannot fail. Have you experienced that a lot in your career?
Those two times are when I really felt it the most. For All American Girl, I mean, I would sit around with Margaret and the other actors in the play, and we would feel a sense of kind of importance, or importance isn't the right word, because we didn't feel full of ourselves, but we felt, oh, well, this is kind of like they're saying this is the first, it was 1995, and there had never been an Asian American family on television before, which we could talk for an hour about that, right?
Yeah.
And so therefore, as a result, you would think, okay, so then here you are, you're the first Asian American family. Now what? Go for it, you guys. You know, like, and knock yourselves out. You know, and actually kind of was a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. The criticism about that show was over-scrutinized, and it didn't last. And it's a shame because of all of, you know, it was a perfectly fine show. It could have been way better, but it was a perfectly fine show. It happens, though, you know. It's like you're talking about being the only Asian in the room or something like that. You have this sense of pressure. When you're the only anything in the room, right, you feel a sense of some kind of pressure to represent or to make good. Not everyone feels this. Arguably, it's possible that a lot of Asian people feel this because they're trained to want to do good and want to not let people down. And that's a huge blanket statement, but we all know what that means.
I mean, it's true.
There's truth to it. There's exceptions to every rule. We have to say that. But we all feel that. Some of the bond that I have with some of my Asian friends is that we feel this, and that it rules our lives. I mean, there are times when I go into Century 21 or something like that, and I'm thinking about what my mother will think about my underwear choices. Mom won't like that. Don't get those. Don't get those. If you get those, don't wear them at her house. You know. You know what I'm saying?
It's yes.
Like that happens. It just,
yes.
You can't help it.
I mean, us making the show, half the time, I just don't want him to be disappointed in me.
Yes, right.
Yeah, we have, between ourselves, we are each other's disappointed parents.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, somebody has to be there by proxy, right?
Yeah,
they have
exactly.
Well, you know. Right, exactly.
So you mentioned earlier that you didn't come out publicly until your son was born.
Yeah.
Why that moment?
First of all, to make a public statement about and come out at the time, this is 2003, was in the world of press releases and things that happen, you know, it's like, what? What are you trying to do? Oh, hello, I'm gay. And it's like not a real, you know, Ellen needed a whole television show episode in order to do it. And that made sense, right? Mm-hmm. It was centered around this thing. There was focus on it. Actually, what happened was I was doing a book tour to go out on the road and talk about this book on the Today Show, and I was going to go on CNN with Anderson Cooper, and I was packing my bags to go on this book tour around the country. And I was packing, like as me, as I usually do, at the last minute and kind of harried, and I thought, oh, wow, you know what? You're coming out. You know, because I didn't realize that I was going out there, and at this point, my son, who had been born through surrogacy, they were going to be like, oh, I wasn't going to be able to kind of say, oh, well, he came from, you know, my ex-wife or something like that. I had no intention of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I realized that this meant, oh, that's like coming out. Mm-hmm. And it was really, it was positive and joyful. And it made me feel good. And I was excited about it. But it was a thing that had to actually hit me. Because I was running around doing all this other stuff. And I thought, oh, yes, okay, yes, coming out. All right, let's do it.
How do you look back on that moment now, sort of having become, I would say, like an icon of like being out and proud?
Yeah, well, the thing that I'm always reminded of is that right after M. Butterfly, I started becoming a professional speaker. I started getting hired to come go to a lot of colleges and universities, and I loved doing it, interfacing with the students and talking to them about all this stuff. And I eventually, after the book came out, I started talking about gay stuff too. But before I started talking about gay stuff, I was very controlled. I had this eToya presentation binder, the kind with the clear plastic sleeves in it that you put your speech in. You know with the one I mean. And I would stand behind the lectern. We don't have one here. And I would stand behind the lectern, and I would read that speech from the beginning to the end, and then I would take questions. And if questions that came up that were uncomfortable for me, I would steer the questions away from my personal life or things like that. And it wasn't until the book came out that I started infusing the gay part of my story into the speech, the presentation. And I literally came out from behind the lectern. I started using a lav. I came out and I realized the first couple of times, oh, wow, this is what it feels like to be me. You know, like I'm just talking to people and I'm just kind of saying, and that's how you do it. And I'm just, whatever I'm saying, I wasn't in that kind of controlled space anymore. And it felt incredibly liberating and extremely satisfying. And I was very happy with that happening so organically to me.
Yeah.
I'll get it. It's one of those Chinese robocalls.
It's true.
Oh my God, we get them so much. She tries to talk to them all the time.
Yeah.
And they always hang up on me. Well, once I got as far as being like, why are you doing this?
Oh, you mean you actually talk? I get these like recorded ones.
Yeah, where they say press one or two for something. Oh, so I always press it.
I don't understand what they're saying. Yeah. So.
He was just like, I don't have a choice. I have to call. And I was like, wow, this is sad.
Yeah.
Anyways, then he hung up on me. Your son is here. We wouldn't want you to not have the opportunity to embarrass him in any way that you feel like you want to. So if there's anything you want to get out there, share a story or two.
He would not respond well to that. And trust me when I tell you that I would be the one that would pay. And so I will take this opportunity to say that he is a recent high school graduate, and I'm very proud of him.
Aww.
Okay. I think we have reached the point in our show where we would love to open it up to some audience Q&A.
Yeah.
If anyone has questions for us or more likely BD.
It's fine. We're cool with it.
The young man in the blue shirt is actually related to me, so
I would. Oh. I think we have to go there.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you say your name and how you know the interviewee?
Oh, my name's Jackson Wong. I don't know. I just came to this panel to see you two. Cool. To see you two. I actually
stumbled
I've never
in off the street,
encountered this individual before sitting to the right. But upon some research, your Twitter bio says BD has no periods. However, that your book cover clearly has periods that were intentionally placed there.
Name.
So can you confirm or deny these allegations?
He's referring to the periods in my name.
Yes. Okay.
Wow, you're just getting red for filth right
yes,
now.
Yes, periods in your name.
Did I not warn you? Well, thank you so much for your question.
Oh, of course, of course.
And thank you for coming tonight. As I told some random person who asked me this a few days ago, there was a time when you don't even know this. I became BD Wong in 1989. Then I got on SVU, and it wasn't until like 2000. It was when you were born that I took the contract on Law and Order SVU because I didn't want to leave New York. And so I stayed on that show for 11 years. And during the course of that show, I had to my driver's license expired, and so I had to put my real name on the driver's license, and I wanted BD Wong to be on my driver's license because it had been well established as my name. So I said, I'm changing my name to BD Wong officially. I'm going to go to the DMV and I'm going to get my name. And at the DMV, they would not allow me to have periods in my name. They were just that DMV weird way about everything. And as a matter of fact, the way that my name came out was B, comma, C, Wong.
No.
Yeah. And I said, I'm not going to be B, comma. So I'm going to be BD, and I'm going to take the periods out. And in order to be kind of consistent, I started to tell everyone in the credits of new projects that I was on. And we told SVU, and there's a period of time in which I'm mostly BD with the periods. And then after that, it is no periods. And when the book came out, it was 2003. And I was still in period mode. I was still having my periods then. That's what happened. You know, I changed all the credit cards. I had to go and I had to get mail and bring them to the DMV and all these credit card companies to redo everything. And now my passport and my driver's license and everything say the same thing. And it is BD without periods. And, you know, it's a nightmare at TSA because they're like, what is this? What is this? You know, and there are plenty of times when I go somewhere or something like Alexa will say, boom.
But no regrets. No regrets.
But no regrets. No.
That's good.
Thank you so much for your question.
I love how hard his son trolled him.
I loved it too. I hope that if I'm ever a dad, my child will come for me like that.
My child will never do that.
Oh, that's true. You will not tolerate that.
I will not tolerate it.
All right, folks, that is it for this time around. But next week, we have one last gift.
And here is a hint. It's about talking, laughing, loving, breathing.
Fighting, fudging, crying, drinking.
Fudging?
I don't know. I've been saying fudging this whole time.
Some of you know exactly what we're talking about, and some of you are a little confused. But either way, we'll see you next week.
See you next time. All right, credits?
Our staff includes Zakiya Gibbons and Jeremy Bloom.
Special thanks this week to Neil Dinesha and Rachel Rosato at Asia Society.
I'm Kathy Tu.
I'm Tobin Lowe.
And Nancy is a production of WNYC Studios.